This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. We start this program in the Caribbean. A new definition of a citizen in the Dominican Republic this fall. Pressure building on Haiti's president and a new effort to reduce Haiti's high rate of women dying while pregnant.
Nous voulons le départ.
What we want is the departure of Michel Martelly. He can no longer govern the country. He is an idiot, a president that has no respect for the country.
That is from the BBC. Last weekend was a national holiday in Haiti, commemorating its path to independence. But instead of celebrations, there were protests, thousands taking over the streets, protesting government corruption, the escalating cost of living in Haiti, and the crushing and persistent poverty on that in that nation. Jacqueline Charles covers the region for the Miami Herald. Tim Padgett is the America's editor for WLRN. They join us here on the Florida Roundup. Jacqueline, first of all, give us the sense of the situation and the protests in Haiti. Are they building toward some kind of conclusion?
Well, I don't know if protests in Haiti ever build toward any kind of conclusion, but I find what's interesting, for instance, last year, the International Crisis Group says there were 128 protests in Haiti. And what we're seeing currently is that the protests are building in numbers. Now, where is this going to lead? No one exactly knows. Yes, people are calling for the departure of President Michel Martelly, but I think that you have a lot of division on that. The frustration is over the current social situation and the delay in the elections.
What do we know about the protesters? Who is it that is taking to the streets?
Well, what you have is majority poor, but you also have a number of opposition senators who are opposed to the president who are involved, and some of them have led some of these protests. There's a lot of rumors or discussions on the ground in terms of former President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, who we haven't talked to. But what I always remind people is to remember that before Famille Lavalas, the party that Aristide became head of was a party. Lavalas was a movement. And I think what you have, because of the power vacuum or leadership vacuum in the opposition, you have people grabbing on to that, and they are taking to the streets to basically show signs of their frustrations of what's happening. And there are a number of issues. I mean, there's the cholera situation. Yep. People are saying that it's time for the UN to leave. People are, you know, complaining about what they perceive as to be the corruption. But I think at the end of the day, almost 3 years after President Martelly was elected, that what a lot of people expected from him, from his leadership, from his government, has not really been realized. And so now we're seeing people taking advantage of that and going into the streets or putting people into the streets.
Tim Padgett, 3 years after the election, almost four years after that awful earthquake, and 8 years since the UN put peacekeepers in Haiti, they remain here today.
And Martelly has not helped his case, really, since being elected in 2011. He was elected by a landslide. We have to remember that. But since then, he really hasn't shown a lot of he's not very adept at democratic give and take. He doesn't seem to show a lot of respect for democratic institutions. And his performance really hasn't been all that stellar. I mean, you have to remember, this was a former carnival singer, never held elected office before he was elected. A lot of people like to say, you know, expectations for him were very low, and he's met them. but again, this problem, why he's not holding these parliamentary elections that should have been held shortly after he was elected in 2011, again, lends itself to this image of populist authoritarianism that he seems to, you know, be carrying with him every day. He's very isolated. There's a lot of cronyism in his administration. And these are the things that lead, that sort of help out, you know, the generation of these protests.
Tim Padgett covers the region for WLRN. Jacqueline Charles covers the Caribbean for the Miami Herald. Do you have relatives in Haiti? What do you hear from them? How about friends, colleagues, business in Haiti? Let us know at 800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576. That's WLRN, by the way, on your touchpad. Also join us on Twitter at WLRN and online with an online web chat being curated right now at WLRN.org. This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. Jacqueline Charles of the Miami Herald, what do we know about any international attention that the protests are getting or have gotten?
Well, the UN is very concerned about the violence that has occurred in some of these protests. I mean, what you have seen, at least in the last two, and by the way, there's another one that's planned for the 29th of November.
Another protest.
Yes, is that you've had pro-Martelly supporters that have thrown rocks at the anti-Martelly supporters, and then you get into this rock-throwing competition. There, you know, guns have gone off, barricades have been lit. You've seen where the police have had to use tear gas as a measure to prevent any sort of a clash. And so that is very much of a concern to the United Nations and the U.S. I mean, the last thing you want is Haiti blowing, right? I mean, it's a place that is relatively calm, but it's volatile. And so you never know when the next protest. But I wanted to follow up something briefly with what Tim was saying. You know, Martelly has his issues. I mean, clearly, and there are issues in the government. But I have to tell you, the opposition and these senators also are not helping their cause. Yeah. Just 2 weeks ago, they had an eight-hour session in where they just, you know, came out with all of these allegations. For instance, that there are 452 consultants assigned to the National Palace, that money that was used for the earthquake from Uruguay was used to paint a slum in Pétionville. And at the end of this eight-hour marathon session, the three members of the government whose jobs were on the line, they survived. So you don't...
No consequences for this and skullduggery.
She's right. And a lot of this has to do with an elite that really can't swallow the fact that a former carnival singer is now their chief executive. And the Obama administration and Martelly's supporters say that a lot of this also obscures some of Martelly's accomplishments. They point to, you know, there have been some infrastructure improvements in Haiti. The education reform seems serious.
Quantity over quality. And I would say that Martelly does have the support of a lot of the elite. I think that what you're coming to now is what's happening, some of these issues that have been buried in Haiti, issues of class. You know, the fact that there's this version or vision that you have a lot of elite that are there, that are in government, and they don't care about the poor. And as a result of that, we're not seeing the country moving forward.
Jacqueline, what are the implications for South Florida? In other words, rush to immigration. We're seeing, you know, Haitian trade, whatever there is of it, at risk. Talk to us about this lens that we're looking at the Caribbean, looking at the difficulty in the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, just offshore.
Well, one of the things that you've started to see that's happening is you're starting to see it peak up in terms of Haitians that are leaving or attempting to get to the U.S. They're not necessarily coming to Florida. They're now going through the Mona Passage via the Dominican Republic to Puerto Rico, and that is very dangerous. Here in South Florida, we had an incident just a couple of weeks ago where we had a boat that capsized.
Right.
And those Haitians actually left from Haiti. So there's always that concern. But for the Haitian community here in South Florida, they very much have this wait-and-see sort of attitude, and they've kind of checked out in a way. They still have to send a remittance. They still have to be concerned about their family, but they really are disappointed. I mean, they are saying this is more of the same. We don't see progress. We don't see it moving
forward.
They're
disengaging now with the country.
They are disengaged, exactly.
Hmm. Jacqueline Charles covers the Caribbean for the Miami Herald. Tim Padgett does the same here for WLRN. This is the Florida Roundup. I'm Tom Hudson. Arika joins us from Coral Gables to talk about Haiti. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. So we are an NGO, and we work in Haiti in a particular region, which is near the capital and goes all the way to the Dominican Republic. Just to build upon what was said before, the issue of the lack of elections, legislative and local elections, has a huge impact on our work as well, because we have mayors who are in office but without a mandate, so they're totally ineffective. And also in areas where the mayors left, the central government has assigned mayors. So this really disenfranchises local population.
Have you seen that affect your ability to get aid to residents? Has that articulated itself in the skullduggery and the corruption that that so many folks have seen?
Well, the issue of the mayors, yes, because they don't have any power. They're just there to push papers. And the new mayors who have been appointed, the local residents really resent that, and there's discontent really brewing in the rural areas as well. So that's one issue that we're dealing with. It's very hard to advance the programs that we have because the mayors, their hands are tied. So that's number one. Number two, the other issue that we are very concerned about is about the Dominican Republic's legislation that passed that strips citizenship of Dominicans who are of Haitian descent, but who were born there.
Right. This,
for the most part,
this was a constitutional court ruling by the Dominican Republic Court in September, Jacqueline, that ruled being born in the DR does not automatically grant citizenship. What are some of those implications for Haiti?
Well, the implications is that, first of all, it affects perhaps as much as 300,000 individuals. And let's be clear, I mean, there's always been this issue in the Dominican Republic over documentation. And you've heard stories in the past about, you know, someone of Haitian descent who was born in the DR, who's a great, you know, baseball prospect, but they can't realize their dream because they have no documentation. And basically what the court did was it codified this. Now, again, every country has a right to make its citizenship rules. The issue here is that it goes back to 1929. It's retroactive. And that has been the huge concern.
And internationally, Tim, there's a concern by some that they may want to point to this kind of retroactive immigration ruling within the hemisphere for own domestic purposes.
In the broader picture, this is a troubling precedent when you start telling people that even if you're born in your country, you can't be a citizen. And you're seeing already some anti-immigration advocates here in the United States pointing to this as saying, well, here we've got a precedent. And so this gives more fuel to the fire of this argument that, well, Mexicans or any other immigrants born here, you know, parents who are bringing, pregnant mothers into the United States so that they can have, you know, babies here. They're being able to point to precedents like this now and saying, well, you know, we've got more of a reason to argue this here.
Enrica, thank you for calling from Coral Gables. Gordon joining us now here on the Florida Roundup from Fort Lauderdale. Gordon, welcome to the program. Go ahead.
Hi there. Yes, you're talking about Haiti and the Dominican Republic.
Your thoughts.
Is there a point that is of question there, please?
You were calling to make a comment, Gordon. What's your comment?
Well, if we're talking about the DR versus Haiti, my opinion is simply this is a terrible time for the DR to undertake such an adventure in the sense of disqualifying existing native-born people from citizenship. I mean, the two countries have intermarried and exchanged genetic pools for the last two and a half, three, four, five centuries, and there is no definition of a pure Dominican or a pure Haitian when it comes to certain items of what you might say genetic strains. And right now, the Dominican Republic, as an economy, is profiting hugely upon the advances being made in Haiti with new construction, reconstruction, and development, going from roads to major buildings and even airports.
Gordon from Fort Lauderdale, lots of nodding here in the room with our Caribbean correspondents. Jacqueline, Charles, respond to that last comment, that last insight that Gordon shared in terms of the DR economic advantage, I suppose, that it's being able to realize.
He's correct. I mean, when you look at the private sector companies that have benefited most off the earthquake, it has been Dominican companies. I mean, they have built new roads. I mean, one in particular even built the Caracol Industrial Park that the U.S. has invested about $300 million with, along with the IDB. And so that is the irony, right? That Dominican businesses have benefited off of this tragedy in Haiti, and they benefit in the Dominican Republic off of Haitian labor. And today, the Dominican Republic wants to say, no, you cannot be part of us, and we're not going to give you documentation, but we need your labor, we need you to do this, and we need you to open avenues for our businesses in Haiti.
Yeah, that's actually been one of the sources of one of the biggest corruption cases we've seen recently involving the Martelly administration, whether or not there were kickbacks from these Dominican executives. And all of this, Tom, I mean, Jacqueline made an excellent point earlier about the diaspora here in South Florida. All of this is breeding this disengagement here, which is a real tragedy, because this election, when Martelly was elected, we were all hoping that a diaspora that had really been sort of shut out of involvement in Haiti's development, especially when Wyclef Jean was trying to run for president, there was this hope that finally, you know, South Florida Haitians would be engaged more with Haiti. But they just feel that here that probably there's really no sense in it anymore.
And also along the lines of the Dominican Republic private sector invested a lot of money in the Haitian elections. And it wasn't just President Martelly who received money, but other candidates received money, and they moved back and forth. And so today, that's also been raised as an issue, that we have not really heard much from President Michel Martelly or Prime Minister Laurent Lamothe about this Dominican issue. You've seen their foreign minister go and lobby. But for Haitians are so upset about this, and they want their leaders to say something about this ruling. And some have said, well, it's the reason why, because of this tangle web of an economic relationship dependency that Haiti and Haitian leaders have had with the Dominicans.
Well, we have certainly seen the public protests in just recent days, recent weeks over internal politics in Haiti. But Haiti also is home to the highest maternal death rate in the Western Hemisphere. Now, maternal death is when a pregnant woman dies from a cause that's related to a pregnancy. And the country is planning, Jacqueline, you're reporting on this weekend, to begin a nationwide contraception campaign this year with the goal of reducing secret abortions. And the campaign comes ahead of the holiday season for a specific reason.
It's a little bit cycle every year because there is, after the New Year's parties and all the carnival parties, a lot of people who get together and then they get pregnant. And then 2 to 3 months after those periods, you will first have an abortion peak. Of course, we don't provoke abortions, but women come in after they either had a spontaneous abortion or they provoked it themselves, and then they come in with the complications.
That's a midwife who works with Doctors Without Borders in Haiti. As we mentioned, the maternal death rate is the highest in the Western Hemisphere in Haiti. What's the goal of this contraceptive campaign? And how is it going to be greeted?
Well, let's first talk about this maternal death. I mean, for every 100,000 babies that are born in Haiti, 630 women die, according to the government's own figures. Some people put that figure at 350 women, but it's still high. And the Ministry of Health believes that 30% of those are because of clandestine abortions.
Secret abortions.
Secret abortions,
right,
that are unsafe and they are illegal in Haiti.
And some of those may be pharmaceutically induced. Some of those may be otherwise.
Exactly. Or the abortion mills that people go to. And the dirty secret in Haiti is that somebody who has money can go to a doctor, a qualified doctor who will do this in a private hospital or a clinic in a sterilized room using anesthesia. But for most of the people, they don't have that money and they have to resort to these extreme measures. So the idea is basically, in this country where there are a lot of taboos, social, religious, cultural taboos about using birth control, to basically get Haitians to start thinking more and more and to start using. And President Michel Martelly, to his credit, earlier this year issued a presidential decree, which, by the way, Tim, was supposed to be a law proposal, but he issued a decree requiring all institutions in the country, private and public, to provide free contraception and free counseling to any woman who wants it. And so the goal is to get more women to use it. The latest study shows that only 31% of married women in Haiti use contraceptives. Mm. It's up from 25%, but that 6 percentage point increase, it's great, but it's still the lowest. And what you find is that there are 35% of Haitian women who are married who say they want birth control, but they lack the access to it.
And when is this campaign will begin? Before the end of this month, is that right?
Well, it was going to begin at the end of this month, but they
and
just...
And where's the funding come from, by the way?
Well, they just told me, first of all, it'll happen in January, which is good because it's right before Carnival.
Right, right, as the midwife was mentioning.
Exactly. And the funding, they're trying to get the funding either through USAID or the United Nations Population Fund. I mean, basically, they're basically scrambling right now to get funds, but it'll be billboards, text messages, just mass media, just trying to get the word out to see how can they take this maternal death crisis, you know, in hand and really do something about it.
Jacqueline Charles covers the Caribbean Basin for the Miami Herald. Tim Padgett does the same for us here at WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. This is the Florida Roundup. Stick around. We have more to come on this edition of the program. In the next segment, our Fort Lauderdale police officers targeting blacks while bicycling. This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. We have an online web chat going right now at WLRN.org. Follow us on Twitter as well, at WLRN. Race and law enforcement now. From Fort Lauderdale to Miami Gardens, police officers face questions about harassment. The stories range from stopping African Americans bicycling in Fort Lauderdale to questionable conduct by Miami Gardens police officers. you have any firsthand or secondhand experience for that matter, let us know. We'd like to hear from you at 1-800-743-WLRN, 1-800-743-9576, our community conversation on Twitter at WLRN, and of course online, as I mentioned, at WLRN.org. Kyle Swenson is with the New Times Broward Palm Beach, and Chris DiMatte with WLRN joining us now to talk about race and law enforcement. And Kyle, you uncovered this story of bicycling while black was the headline in your publication. What did you find in Fort Lauderdale?
Well, the city of Fort Lauderdale has a unique ordinance whereby everyone in the city, or all residents, have to register their bikes with the city. And anyone who doesn't have a... Basically, when you register, you get a small sticker. Mm-hmm. And when you don't register, you can be cited for not having that sticker. When we crunched the numbers, going back about 2010, since from 2010 to this summer, there's been about 460 citations given, and about 86% of those citations were given to African Americans.
And the source of the citation was not having the registration sticker?
Correct.
And the registration sticker, presumably public safety anti-theft measure. Is that the official statement?
Well, that's kind of interesting that you bring that up, because you would think that this would be a registration program. But when it was originally conceived back in the early 90s, it was specifically thought of as a law enforcement provision whereby police could go after people on bikes to see if they were stolen bikes, because at the time there was a high rate, very, very high rate of stolen bikes in Fort Lauderdale.
Makes sense. Anti-theft. If all bikes are registered and you pull somebody over, you run the registration number, you can find out if they're the rightful owner or registrant of
Correct.
The bicycle.
Correct. But as I said, you know, over the past 3 years, that kind of disparity between there being 86% of these given out to African Americans, and also, you know, if you plot that out on a map of the city, it's all very localized in the northwest section of the city, which is a predominantly African American part of town.
And as you walked through the statistics, quantified this, put it on a map, it led you to this headline of biking while black.
Correct. Well, also, when we first reported these statistics, the Broward public defender, Howard Finkelstein, had sent a letter to the state attorney's office claiming, you know, being very bold that this was a racist program and that it was the same thing as driving a car while black or walking while black, that this was racial profiling.
In terms of the way that the Fort Lauderdale police
were employing,
seemed to be targeting black bicyclists.
Correct.
And the official response from law enforcement in Fort Lauderdale to this has been what?
Well, interestingly, you know, the police were very upfront when we first reported this, and throughout the whole time when I worked on this larger story, you know, they had said that, yes, we do use this program for this purpose. And they were very open and said that, you know, the reason we use this is because we have drug dealers, prostitutes, burglars, all on bikes in certain neighborhoods, and that we use this program to check on them and to target them.
They in fact said to target those kinds of...
Well, I would back off, I guess, the word target. But they did say that this was a tool that they were using specifically to fight crime in these neighborhoods where people breaking the law, like I said, drug dealers primarily, but also prostitutes and burglars, were on bikes. And Chief Adderley of the Fort Lauderdale Police Department was very, very specific that he was responding to the concerns of the community.
Right. Kyle Swenson writes for the New Times Broward Palm Beach. Christine DiMatte with WLRN also with us. I'm Tom Hudson. This is the Florida Roundup. Join the conversation online at WLRN.org and join it on the telephone as well. Have you been subject to the kind of targeting that Kyle has identified in his publication? Does it affect your neighborhood? 800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576, or WLRN. Rob joins us now from Northwest Fort Lauderdale. Rob, welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you. But yeah, I live in Northwest Fort Lauderdale. From my household, there's been 3 bikes stolen in the last 4 years or so, and there's been dozens of bikes at all my friends. I'm a member of the local civic association. Twice a year, we have a registration program. We go to everybody because it costs $1 to register, and we do it for free for all the little kids.
The bikes that you had stolen, Rob, were they registered?
2 were, 1 was not.
And have you had any follow-up at all with law enforcement on those that were registered? Have they popped back up in the system, in other words?
No, they have not. But what they do allow you to do is after like 90 days or so, they do get a lot of recovered bikes that are never claimed. If you got a legitimate claim, they don't find yours. You get to pick one from the pile. but the thing is, though, you know, it's such a big problem, and we hardly encourage the crackdown and all that stuff. I mean, they've looked at me. I'm 64-year-old white guy. You know, I don't.
What do you mean they've looked at you? The police,
I mean,
the
cops have stopped me and make sure I have my sticker, because mine's kind of on the bottom. I got it in a bad place, but it's there. And you know, and we try, and we encourage the police to stop everybody, because there's been so many incidents. Most recently, 2 weeks ago, my poor neighbor who's on disability and isn't the sharpest crayon in the box, and he had his bike stolen. It's a shame.
Rob joining us from Northwest Fort Lauderdale. His personal experience there, Kyle, with stolen bicycles. It does beg the question. I mean, how big of a theft problem is this?
Well, I guess I would say that the theft problem is definitely big. People do steal bicycles. I don't have the particular statistics on that, though I do know they did go down since this program was implemented around 1998, I believe, or 99. But I would say that kind of what really hammered home this to me was when, you know, I went out to the African-American community. I talked to people.
Yeah.
And a lot of the people, you know, lower income individuals in that community kind of just accepted this as a regular part of life, that you'll be harassed on your bike if it's not registered by the police.
Is this akin to the stop and frisk debate that has been raging in New York City?
I mean, I think you can make that correlation, definitely. And what also hammered home is then I did the inverse. I went to the beach where people are riding their bikes all the time, and I stopped predominantly white people. I think it was mostly white people, and I asked them if they had their bikes registered, and they looked at me like I was crazy. I
mean, never heard of that.
They had never
before.
Even heard of it. In fact, they even took like offense that even I would ask them that this program even existed.
This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. Eric joins the conversation from Fort Lauderdale. Eric, welcome to the program.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much. I'd like to say I'm a 66-year-old white guy hippie, you know, from the old days, and I don't really want to see anybody get hassled, really, but there, not only have I had a bike stolen just in the time I turn around, but a lot of guys are riding crazily, cutting in and out of traffic and breaking every law, you know, that there is out there just for safety, you know, in and out of traffic, and then cuss at you, you know, when you have to slam on the brakes to avoid hitting them.
It brings up an interesting question here, Eric, and thank you for spurring it to Kyle Swenson. Is it a primary reason to stop somebody to ask about bicycle registration, or does there have to be a primary reason that's a secondary cause?
Well, this is the bike registration check would be the first reason, would be the reason to.
So you don't have to be weaving in and out of traffic, ignoring traffic laws and stop signs and stoplights.
Oh, no.
You could just be riding down in a legal manner, have your headlight, have your helmet, everything's good, and be pulled over.
Yes. And if you read the police reports, or if you read the citations, very often it's very brief what the officer has written, just said, so-and-so was not observed with registration, so we pulled him over.
Walter joins the conversation here on the Florida Roundup from Fort Lauderdale. Go ahead, Walter.
Good day, gentlemen, and thank you very much for taking my call. The reason for my call is that, first of all, I do understand that the issues about theft and drug dealers and so forth. But there is also a portion of this, in my opinion, that it is, to some degree, profiling. I have a friend. He's in his early 60s. He had been unemployed for a while. He was kind of down in his luck, but he has a bicycle. So he finally got a job. He'd been working on it for about 2 weeks. And a Fort Lauderdale police officer stopped him one day on his way to work. And his excuse was he ran a stop sign on his bicycle. Hmm. I kid you not. I actually know this gentleman. I actually went to court that day when he was actually arrested. He stayed in jail for about 3 days. Now, when he was stopped, he claims that he asked the police officer, he said, well, why did you pull me over? He said, well, you ran a stop sign. He goes, officer, are you kidding me? He said, you pulled me over for running a stop sign on my bicycle? And then, a little bit of a, you know, tit for tat ensued. And the officer got a little upset and arrested the guy. And so I'm sitting there in the courtroom. Now, this guy just got his job. He's about to lose his job because nobody knows where he is. When he finally was able to call someone, they called me since I know him. And I went to court that day because I figured, you know, something as simple as that, they can't do much to this guy.
All right, Walter joining us with that story out of Fort Lauderdale in regards to at least the perception, certainly, Kyle, of racial profiling and bicycling a while back. Kyle Swenson is with the New Times Broward, Palm Beach, Christine DiMatte with WLRN, and Julie Brown from the Miami Herald has joined us as well. This is the Florida Roundup. I'm Tom Hudson. And, Chris, you know, what's interesting is you hear this story of of race and law enforcement in Fort Lauderdale, around this neighborhood in Fort Lauderdale. And emblematic of these tensions was a dispute over a street in Fort Lauderdale that you'd been covering all this autumn long, 6th Street, over part of the railroad tracks that is called Sistrunk Avenue. Tell us about
Sistrunk Boulevard.
Tell us about the naming of Sistrunk, Dr. Sistrunk.
Well, Dr. James Sistrunk is a hero in this community. He opened the first African-American hospital in Fort Lauderdale back in the late 30s, delivered about 5,000 babies, a huge hero to this neighborhood. I think it was 1966 they named that stretch of 6th Street after him, but only up until Andrews Avenue,
right,
at which point it becomes Northeast 6th Street. And east of that, up to federal highways, now gentrifying quickly into a predominantly white neighborhood. So for the longest time, there was this debate about whether to extend the Sistrunk Boulevard name all the way east, okay, because for a long time, this was the heart of the black commercial neighborhood.
And one of those neighborhoods now is Flagler Village.
Correct.
What are the residents, the reaction that they've had to this effort to extend the naming of Sistrunk Boulevard eastward?
Okay, it's been very interesting because up until October 21st, their concern was Sistrunk Boulevard. They revere Dr. Sistrunk and everything he stands for. But over the years, unfortunately, Sistrunk Boulevard has become known for, carried with it negative connotations of the theft, the drug dealing, the prostitution, I mean, urban blight. It became a rough neighborhood. So the folks in Flagler Village were very, very concerned about that name being extended into their neighborhood.
But what happened in late October?
Okay, very interesting. After months and months of voting against, just categorically against extending that name, all of a sudden a change of heart. And that struck a lot of people as very, very weird. It's very, very, very odd.
Fort Lauderdale City Commissioner Dean Trentalis represents Flagler Village, this predominantly white neighborhood that was resisting initially the extension of the Sistrunk name into their area.
There's this history in Fort Lauderdale, and I'm very upset that this city has ever had to experience any kind of racial discrimination. So let's get past that, and let's see if we can sign on to this effort, because I think it's important that we try to connect neighborhoods and not disconnect them.
Okay, so the overall feeling by the Fort Lauderdale City Commission is, let's just heal this breach. Let's just settle this. They voted unanimously yes. Now it's good. The street is going to be co-branded. Northeast 6th Street on signage up above, below that in parentheses, Sistrunk Boulevard. However, the unanswered question is, the folks in Flagler Village, there's a sense that the folks were strong-armed into voting yes, okay? Mm.
And to make the issue go away.
Yeah, there's still, we just spoke, the third gentleman on the phone spoke about profiling. There are some folks in Flagler Village who feel that they were being reverse profiled, that they were being called racist, and they felt uncomfortable about that, hence the vote.
Race and politics, race and police here in South Florida. This is the Florida Roundup. Christine DiMatte with WLRN along with us, Kyle Swinson from New Times, Broward, Palm Beach, and Julie Brown from the Miami Herald. And Julie, we have to ask about this story about Miami Gardens police and singling out customers and employees of a single convenience store. Talk us through this story.
Well, this started probably about, first of all, the police department in Miami Gardens was formed about 10 years ago. And since that time, murder has doubled. Other crimes have dropped, but for the most part, violent crime is at an all-time high. Citizens, understandably, are very upset about this, and they've asked the police department to try to do something to remedy this. The controversy has arisen where the police now have seemingly started to haul in people for very minor nuisance offenses, mm-hmm, such as trespassing, littering, carrying open containers of alcohol. And this has all kind of come to a head with this little convenience store in the heart of their city, in which one of these store owners felt that his customers were unfairly targeted.
Supporters of strong law enforcement, and we saw this in New York in the 90s with Rudy Giuliani, say go after those petty crimes so that you stop them then. before they turn into major crimes.
Yes, that's what a lot of people have come to call the broken window theory. However, experts say this theory doesn't work across the board. It only works in areas where the police have gained the trust of the community and the community understands what they are doing. And they have the backup of the community.
And what they're doing, you've seen the video surveillance from this one convenience store. It's on the website, a link to it on our web chat at WLRN.org. While there's no audio to it, so it doesn't really work for our purposes here on the radio, the video is certainly striking. What do you see in those videos, Julie, as a reporter?
Well, you see these people trying to go and do their business at the store. Some of them are standing there ready to go into the store, and they're just being stopped by police who ask them for their identification. And the next thing you see is that they're sticking their hands in the customer's pockets, or they're...
These are the cops sticking their hands in the customer's pockets.
And there's video of them... the cops going into this convenience store, asking to use the restroom, and then opening the door to the restroom. And instead of going in the restroom, they're putting their flashlights in all the back room and literally just searching this store.
Seems like a constitutional question there.
Right. And this store owner actually installed these cameras in the middle of last year because this had been going on for a long time, and he thought, this doesn't seem right to me. There's mm-hmm. something really wrong. And after he complained to the police department, they started intensifying these sweeps of his customers. So he decided to do this, and he has collected quite a cachet of video surveillance.
And is there a lawsuit in the making? Has there been a civil rights accusation made?
Yes, there's a federal civil rights lawsuit being prepared. It probably will be filed sometime next week.
And the response from the police to this reporting, I know it's still early in the reporting process in terms of the publication of this and really bringing full airing to it in terms of the public acknowledgement of it. But again, that police response of going after those petty crimes, the broken window theory, Julie, trying to stop the broken windows, clean up the broken windows before we turn into broken homes and neighborhoods.
Well, the bottom line is, like I said, that only works if the residents trust the police. When you see police officers doing things like this, going into stores, taking out employees who work there and putting on the report that they were loitering outside when they were clearly inside the store stocking a case of beverages, that only... creates a stronger culture of mistrust.
Do you have a sense, though, that the video is not showing the entire story? There's more to uncover here. I mean, some of these folks that had been arrested by the police did have police records, did have arrest records. So they weren't necessarily angels themselves. But is there more here that you're beginning to cover now, beginning to understand, beginning to even hear about as this story garners more attention?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say one thing. I've covered a lot of police corruption, yeah. especially within the past couple of years here in South Florida. And there are really a lot of good cops here in South Florida. And we tend to focus on the cops that are bad cops. And I think the problem is the good cops are afraid to speak out sometimes. Mm. And in this particular case, I really believe that there are some good cops on this force that are behind this change, and that they have gotten fed up, and they are also starting to talk to the right people.
I see. Julie Brown covering this for the Miami Herald, Christine DiMatte with WLRN covering Sistrunk Boulevard, and Kyle Swenson for New Times Broward Palm Beach with the Biking While Black in Fort Lauderdale story, all here on the Florida Roundup. Thank you to all of you for joining us. Still to come on the program, the Miami City Commission gets its youngest member ever, dropping an effort to extend the urban development boundary, and the Miami Book Fair International turns 30. I'm Tom Hudson. This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. Thanks for listening. Politics this week in South Florida. A new member of the Miami City Commission elected, the youngest ever in an effort to expand the development boundary in Miami-Dade, is retracted. It's pulled back. Brian Bandel is with the South Florida Business Journal. Wilson Sayre with WLRN and Patty Mazzei with the Miami Herald will join us in a moment. Wilson Sayre with us now. You've covered this District 5 race for the Miami City Commission. It was a runoff race. Lots of focus, lots of attention to this race. Tell us about the winner.
Yeah, so Keon Hardiman, this is kind of his first foray into politics here in Miami. He started last year with a failed race for the Miami-Dade County Commission seat. Mm-hmm. But it's really interesting this race in particular was really focused on partly because of there's a lot of fodder from Dunn's campaign, some weird bookkeeping, fodder for his opponents. But I think the kind of more interesting part of this race was that this is a new District 5 that we're looking at.
It was reconstituted. The borders had changed. Tell us about the neighborhood.
Yeah, so District 5 is a historically Black community, lower income, Liberty City Overtown, Lemon City, and now a huge chunk of the Upper East Side neighborhood, which is middle to upper income, more white people, essentially, in that neighborhood. And that's caused a little bit of kind of eyebrow raising on the political side. But I think what is more of a challenge for that neighborhood is the kind of income inequalities that right. now are constituting one district.
And we saw in terms of a big municipal election, if we can look to New York City, not compare New York City and District 5 here in Miami City, but New York City's election for the mayor was significantly about income disparity. Did that come about in this runoff election that we had this week for District 5 in Miami City?
Well, it's hard to say at this point. I think part of that is because the district lines only were released this summer. Mm-hmm. And so there wasn't really a lot of time for the Upper East Side to come together behind perhaps a candidate of their own. And so there really wasn't a ton of kind of changes in the way that they ran their campaigns. But I think, you know, it's something for the future to play out. And it's going to be very interesting to watch that.
A 30-year-old commissioner, youngest ever on the Miami City Commission. Wilson Sayre walking us through the runoff election that was held this week for District 5 for the Miami City Commission. Patty Mazzei with the Miami Herald with us now. And Patty, some interesting goings on at the county side as well within Miami-Dade. Some consternation around the possible expansion of the urban development boundary, but almost at the 11th hour, the request was retracted. What happened?
Well, it appeared to everybody who was there that they kind of counted votes and knew that it was going down. And so the developer, instead of letting the commission deny the request, which would kind of set a precedent for the application ever coming back, they decided to withdraw at the last minute. So there was no actual vote held on the merits of the application to expand the urban development boundary.
Brian Bandel with South Florida Business Journal. You've covered a lot of real estate here in That's South right. Florida, and this ultimately is a real estate development question, because you had some significant deep-pocketed developers that were looking to build a mall and a water park, I believe it was.
That's right. Turnberry Development, the group behind the Aventura Mall, the group headed by Jeffrey Sofer and Jackie Sofer, they're the owners of this site. And now that they have postponed the development plans, they're going to have a big litigation problem. In June, a group owned by the former parent company of Bank Atlantic, a group called BBX Capital, filed a lawsuit against Sofer trying to enforce the personal guarantee on this loan. There's a $12 million loan on this property. And it's hard to get that money out unless you develop it or do something with it. It's hard to sell it if you don't get development rights. Otherwise, it's just a bunch of trees.
It's a property that's outside the urban development boundary, and it's property that has some kind of value, Patty, but not nearly the kind of value if we wind up gerrymandering this boundary to include this property tract.
And that's one of the things that the opponents of moving the boundary have always said, which is the county doesn't have to set policy in order to help the people who speculate when they buy land outside of the UDB. Of course, there's some commissioners who I think would have probably gone for the expansion, but I think they were really in the minority on this one. This one brought out even the rock mine operators and the environmentalists on the same side, which is fairly unusual. And the county planners, the mayor's office, they just really didn't have support.
Just curious, Patty, what was your read on it? Was it retracted? Did it not seem to have the votes because of the development itself, or because the kind of the thing speaks for itself in terms of the urban development boundary and sticking to the strategy, the broader strategy of that boundary?
Well, don't forget that next year is an election year for half of the commissioners, and the UDB is one of those issues that can turn out some people at the polls, people who are unhappy when the UDB gets moved. So this is not the kind of thing that would go over well the year before an election.
Brian, do we expect this to come back at all anytime soon?
I think for Turnberry, they need to do something to get their money out of this.
Yeah.
And for SOFR, it's either get the development rights on this site so you can build on it or sell it, or pay $12 million to BBX Capital, headed by Alan Levan, who is very good at litigation. He's been able to squeeze some money out of some developers in the past. So he needs to do something to increase the value of the site, or he's going to have to come out of pocket for it.
Brian Bandel with South Florida Business Journal, Wilson Sayre with WLRN, and Patty Mazzei with the Miami Herald. I'm Tom Hudson. This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. From politics now to the 30th Miami Book Fair International this week. Co-founder Mitch Kaplan was there at the beginning.
From what was going to be just a few tables in a Bayfront park turned into something that was world class.
World class indeed, and Mitch was there at the beginning, and Brian, this 30th anniversary, you're going to be there as a author yourself. Before we talk about that, though, your thoughts as a South Floridian and the message that this 30 years of the Miami Book Fair International sends, not only to the local community, but to the broader community.
It shows that we have a real passion for reading. You know, they've done book fairs in New York City before that haven't lasted this long. And New York is, you know, the literary capital for the whole industry there, a lot of the big publishers there.
It's the business capital of publishing, yeah.
But here we have so many readers, you know, local readers. We have people who are international who are flying in. We have a huge amount of Spanish book programming this year. In fact, my panel, they're going to have an author from Portugal there. So there's such a great international community here that everyone likes to come together to Miami and celebrate literature.
And I know the purists out there will say Portugal is not Spanish, Brian, but it's within the broader context of the Latin influence, certainly, that the book fair has gone international. But only one of the three bookstores that were there at the founding is still operating today, Books and Books and Mitch Kaplan. The industry has changed considerably, but the book fairs had to respond to that as well.
Yeah, I mean, the book fair has invited a lot more authors. They're promoting what they're doing online much more than ever. In fact, Kobo, the e-reader maker, is going to be there this year promoting their product. And one of the groups there, the Rock Bottom Remainders, the author band with Stephen King and Dave Berry, they're going to be handing out cards with the QR code because they have a book that's only online, so they can't sell it physically. So here, buy this card, buy this QR code, and download it. So it's changing, but the fact that you see so many people coming to the fair, I think it's clear that physical books are here to stay.
Well, you've brought one with you, and it's got your name on it, Mute by Brian Bandel. What is the book fair and the opportunity to be part of a panel mean for an author like yourself?
It's a great opportunity because as you alluded to, a lot of the local bookstores aren't there anymore. Books and Books is there, and I'm thrilled to be doing a signing with them in January, but there aren't as many stores to go to. So to have a platform like the book fair is tremendous.
And it still celebrates local authors like yourself. While it has gone international and pulls in these big names and they crowd into MIA on a Thursday or Friday, you still have that cultivation of the local talent.
Absolutely. And in fact, you know, during the years as I was working to complete my book and to get a publishing deal, I attended the book fair a lot. I met a lot of published authors and I spoke to them. I asked them questions. I met people who do books about writing. There was a great book, The Forest for the Trees, talking about the business of publicity and how to get a publisher and all that. And that was so much help for me. You know, they have a lot of great events that cultivate local authors at this fair.
4:30 on Sunday is your event. Topic will be what?
The topic will be about how my life and influenced my novel Mute. The novel is a murder mystery science fiction about a little girl, a 12-year-old girl, is the only witness to the death of her parents and a serial killer going around in Florida. A female police officer takes her in. That story is actually a metaphor for the relationship between me and my mother, and I'll be talking about that at the book fair on Sunday.
Author and financial reporter here in South Florida, Brian Bandel with the South Florida Business Journal, author of Mute, 4:30 on Sunday at the Miami Book Fair International. Thank you to all our guests and callers and emailers and bloggers for joining this conversation for the Florida Roundup. The program will be back on the radio tomorrow morning at 6 a.m. It'll be on later this afternoon on WLRN.org. The program is produced by Elaine Chen and Alicia Zuckerman. Our Public Insight Network analyst is Steph Farrow. Our executive producer is Peter J. Merritt. Technical supervision by Paul Leary. South Florida Arts Beat is next, including a conversation with North Miami's Museum of Contemporary Art's new director. I'll be back Monday morning for the Sunshine Economy. Thanks for listening.